I have a special guest with me via phone. Julie Allen, a local farmer, is with me. And I don't know if, Julie, have I had you on before?
You know, I think we have. I direct the Harvest Festival, so I think we talked about
okay.
that.
Yeah.
And I'm with the Sustainable Farming Association.
Yes, and I think we've talked about that, but probably never about your own farm. So I'm so happy to have you on this morning. You are a great contributor to our community dinner locavore meal last month with squash, which was in incredibly good shape. And by the way, disappeared almost instantly. I cut it up in as many pieces as I could, stuffed it with wild rice and syrup. And the first, 20 people got it. And the first 20 people wanted it. So that was the end of that squash. But amazing that you managed to keep it for so long. Do you have a root cellar or how do you preserve your stuff? Okay.
Winter squash are just one of the best vegetables to grow, I think, because as long as you cure them once after you harvest them, so by curing them, you're allowing the rind to really dry out and harden.
Yeah.
And therefore protect the nice flesh on the inside. So they just need like a warm space with a lot of airflow for a couple weeks. And then they want to store at the average basement temperature. So 50 degrees and 50% humidity.
Hmm.
Yeah. So really anybody can store winter squash in your basement until May or June. It's really, an amazing vegetable.
You know, I am so glad to hear that because I have tried to store squash before, but I don't think I give it the time for the outside to dry out because it usually goes moldy in a month or two. So what you're saying is first keep it out in a warm, windy spot. And how do you know when it's ready to take down to the basement then?
Yeah, so I will check the cut stem and I want to see that, to be very dry and almost corky.
It turns
out very corky. And if you still see any bright green or any moisture around the stem, then it's not ready yet. And then the other important thing is that if it has any damage on it at all, like even a tiny little scratch sometimes, those are going to be the ones that won't store as long. So those go into our eat first pile.
Okay.
And then one absolutely perfect, no blemishes, no bruises, those will last for a very long time.
Ah, so helpful. And it also will encourage me and hopefully other listeners to take a harder look at our squash before we decide what category they belong in. I can see how if it's not compromised at all, and if you really secure the covering, that's why it lasts so long. That's really helpful to hear.
Yeah, and then a lot of winter squash, they actually get sweeter over time in storage, which is why they're just so amazing.
Yeah.
And I encourage people to, load up on winter squash from your friendly local farmers in the fall, or, let us cure it for you and then buy your big box of squash and have it for the winter in your basement.
Yeah.
If you're growing your own.
Absolutely. There's no reason to eat anything other than local squash year round until supply runs out, I say.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, and then you also have managed to, you gave us a bunch of jars of bear fat for this meal, which I will tell you, I tossed them with potatoes just like any oil, and those potatoes went really quickly, roasted potatoes, and also the dessert we made got rave reviews, and there were a few people that were a little surprised to hear that this came with bear fat. But tell us where you got it, and there were some people that wondered how this was come by.
Yeah, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. We like it a lot. It's our primary fat and oil that we use at home, and I know some other friends do it also. So I get the bear fat from a local processor who, I don't want to give away my source here, but we don't hunt bear, but a lot of people do, and I hope in an ethical manner. But they give away the bear fat because otherwise you know, if the hunter doesn't want it, then it just is a waste product. And yeah, so we get like, you know, as much of it as we want, 40, 50, 100 pounds, and then render it like you would any other lard. And which just means I cut it up into small chunks and heat it on the stovetop until the, yeah, the fat renders and you're left with cracklings at the end. And we usually give those to our chickens in the winter so they have a little extra fat to keep warm. Yeah, it's a really pretty simple process. The cutting is can be time consuming, but it is so worth it. And like you discovered, I deep fat fry with it. I bake with it. Anything in the skillet. Yeah, I like roasted, sliced delicata squash tossed in bear fat with salt and pepper is a for sure crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. It's our favorite local fat until we get a good hazelnut population here of hybrid hazelnuts that we can extract oil from. And I think that will be an exciting, exciting day when we have a really good source of plant-based fat and oil. But for now, we're pretty content with the bear fat.
Yeah, that is so, it's just really neat to hear because I have, there's a few gaps in my local food diet, and I know oil is one and grains is another, and to really hear that this viable option, especially since it's fats that really might just go to waste otherwise. I'm so glad you're doing this. Do you sell that fat or were you just being really generous with us?
Yeah, I don't sell it normally. It's not, since it's just out of my kitchen.
Yeah.
Not commercially, but I encourage people to do it at home, you know, with their whatever really pork fat or bear fat or whatever fat you can get your hands on. Having some lard on hand is very nice.
Yeah. I mean, people think of it as gamey, but it's not gamey at all. It's essentially just really clean, good fat that can be heated and yeah, it's just great stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I'll put a plug in here for just being pro fat and eating animal fat, you know, animals that were either raised in, you know, lived in the wild or grown on a farm in a very healthy way on pasture and stuff. That fat is just really, really good for our bodies and our brains, and especially for little kids, very important. And just trying to push back on the low fat craze that I think did a lot of harm.
Yeah. You know, I have a nephew, he's now 30 years old, but when he was young, and my sister was, I think, doing vegetarian at the time, but anyway, he was struggling, a little boy, and she went to a doctor who said he needs to have cream in his cereal and bacon for breakfast every morning. And she did it, and it worked. You know, I think I totally agree with you on the fat thing. And, you know, I'm sure different amounts for different people, but we need our fat to digest. We need it to think. We need fat. That's why we crave it. I don't know. We're getting on to digressing a little bit, but, and I'm sure.
But it's all really a local food thing, you know. And being like a healthy dose of fat mixed with a whole bunch of vegetables and, you know, a diversified diet is super important. And that's what we try to, how we try to eat and what we hope to provide for other people too is, the diversity of stuff that we can grow in northern Minnesota, which we're continuing to explore. And, you know, there's so many vegetables that people are unfamiliar with still because you won't find them in the average grocery store. But I think we're kind of on the brink of like there's more exciting stuff happening. I mentioned hazelnuts and then other small grains. I hope we'll see more of that. You mentioned that as a it's definitely a gap in a lot of our diets of things that can be produced locally. And wild rice, of course, we're so lucky to live in the wild rice region of the world.
Yes.
But otherwise, there's some projects going on to try to encourage more growing of small grains. So meaning grains on a small scale, but also like unusual ones.
Yeah.
Not just wheat, but millet and buckwheat and barley and oats and corn and, you know, there's lots of other things that can be grown here.
Yeah. And, are you doing any of these, Julie? Are you guys experimenting with anything, or what is your garden going to look like this year?
Yeah, so we've only been on this farm since 2020, and it's expanded every year that we've been here, our growing space. I have always, since a young adult, had a love affair with corn, which is kind of ironic because I'm from Illinois, which is like, you know, one of the corn growing mecca, and corn and soybeans kind of have this really bad reputation because of how they're grown on such a large scale and in a monoculture. But corn is such a, you know, it's an ancient plant from the Americas that have sustained the people here for millennia. And going back to the roots of corn, like, so I like to grow the flint corn and dent corn and flower corn that are just so fun to grow because these plants grow 7 feet in a matter of a couple months, you know, and then make this huge cob. Like, it's just an amazing plant to witness.
Yeah.
And then I love growing the flint corn, which we, you know, it dries on the cob and then we shell it, which is one of the favorite activities of my 2-year-old, shelling the corn. And then I make hominy from it by nixtamalizing the corn kernels with lime or ash. And then from that, you can make masa to make corn tortillas or tamales or things of that nature. And if you don't nixtamalize it, you can grind it and just make your average cornmeal. So that's one of our favorite things to grow. And it's just like, yeah, very fruitful, a little bit challenging in our short growing season. So we're transplanting more and more corn this year instead of direct feeding it to give it a little extra boost. But otherwise, I was going to mention and see if you've talked to the people at the Finland food chain, because they're trying to use the wild rice processing equipment for small grains, because that's a big bottleneck, is, you know, growing buckwheat or whatever is one thing, but then actually harvesting it in a, you know, in an efficient manner that's not entirely by, and then once you harvest it, almost all grains have to be threshed to lose their the seed coating, and then they have to be winnowed to separate the seed from the chaff. And so the Finland food chain has this equipment, and they'll be experimenting with using it for different kinds of small grains. Mustard seed is another one that I didn't mention. That's exciting. And I know some other farmers down in Carleton County are also trying to experiment with it. So I hope to see lots more of that. And we don't really have the space for it, but if I ever get more growing space, we'll definitely do more of that.
That is really exciting. We do talk to Finland food chain people, and I think I've even talked about this, but it sounds like it's constantly advancing, so it's probably time for another conversation. We're pretty much out of time, Julie. This went really quickly, but are you part of the Clover Valley Farm Trail and or the Farmers Market?
Yeah, not the Farmers Market, but we are on the Clover Valley Farm Trail. So we're all open Sunday afternoons from 12 to 5, and some of us are open more than that. And people can check out clovervalleyfarmtrail.com for more info.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And do you have anything fresh yet? Just a little spoiler alert.
Yeah, so this week is kind of an exciting week. We still have fresh herbs and rhubarb and green onions and plant starts, of course. And then we'll be harvesting kale and spinach and salad greens and hopefully radishes too.
Wow. Amazing. That's pretty early. What's the name of your farm?
We are called Sorestad.
Oh, yes. Sorestad, I believe, with a two little dots over the E. That's got to have a story behind it.
Over the O. Yeah, the umlaut over the O. Yeah, it's my grandfather's a family name that they dropped at some point after they're in the States. And so it's in homage to my grandfather and his family.
Wonderful. Thank you, Julie. And I hope to have you again before too long. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Julie Allen of the Storestad Farm.